Friday night, February 14th, St. Valentine's Day. George Anastaplo, A-N-A-S-T-A-P-L-O, breathed his last at his home on South Harper Avenue in Hyde Park and died at 88 after a brief bout with a very serious and metastatic prostate cancer. George had been well, really, all of his 88 years until this disease. And even though he was 88, it has had a great effect on many of us, losing him. Such an active mind, eye, ear, and heart. We'll be having much more to say about George Anastaplo in the near future, but we wanted tonight, as a partial tribute to George, to rebroadcast the first of our Abraham Lincoln Reconsidered series from 4 or 5 years ago. George was our informal advisor for that series and our guest for episode 1. And we present it to you now in its entirety.
We are coming, Father Abram, 300,000 more, from Mississippi's winding stream and from New England shore. We leave our plows and workshops, our wives and children dear, with hearts too full for utterance, with but a silent tear. We dare not look behind us, but stand as before. We are coming, Father Abram, 300,000 more. We are coming, coming, our union to restore. We are coming, Father Abram, with 300,000 more. We are coming, coming, our union to restore. We are coming, Father Abram, with 300,000 more.
Old Abe Lincoln came out the wilderness, came out the wilderness, came out the wilderness. Old Abe Lincoln came out the wilderness many long years ago. Many long years ago, many long years ago. Old Abe Lincoln came out the wilderness, came out the wilderness, came out the wilderness. Old Abe Lincoln came out the wilderness many long years ago. Old Jeff Davis tore down the government, tore down the government, tore down the government. Old Jeff Davis tore down the government many long years ago. Many long years ago, many long years ago. Old Jeff Davis tore down the government, tore down the government, tore down the government. Old Jeff Davis tore down the government many long years ago. But old Abe Lincoln built up a better one, built up a better one, built up a better one. Old Abe Lincoln built up a better one many long years ago. Many long years ago, many long years ago. Old Abe Lincoln built up a better one many long years ago.
Happy birthday to you.
Yeah!
Happy birthday, Abe. But I'm not dying for no white man.
In the beauty of the lilies, Christ was born across the sea, with a glory in his bosom that transfigures you and me. As he died to make men holy, let us die to make men free.
While God is marching on,
glory, glory, hallelujah.
Welcome to the first, a preview in some ways, in a series of broadcasts, Abraham Lincoln Reconsidered, in cooperation with the Chicago History Museum. I'm your host and producer for this series, Andrew Patner. During our series, you'll be hearing conversations about many aspects of our 16th president, born 200 years ago on February 12, 1809. Our programs will also feature Lincoln's own words, music of the period of Lincoln's life, and written in response to him and his legacy. Today, we'll feature an introductory conversation with philosopher, law professor, and Lincoln scholar George Anastoplo of Chicago, author of the essential Abraham Lincoln, A Constitutional Biography, available now in paperback from Roman and Littlefield. We'll also hear Lincoln's own words from Gettysburg in 1863 and from his second inauguration in Washington, D.C. in 1865. They'll be read for us by Chicago actor Richard Hensel.
Fellow countrymen, at this second appearing to take the oath of the presidential office, there is less occasion for an extended address than there was at the first. Then, a statement somewhat in detail of a course to be pursued seemed fitting and proper. Now, at the expiration of 4 years, during which public declarations have been constantly called forth on every point and phase of the greatest contest, which still absorbs the attention and engrosses the energies of the nation, little that is new could be presented. The progress of our arms, upon which all else chiefly depends, is as well known to the public as to myself, and it is, I trust, reasonably satisfactory and encouraging to all. With high hope for the future, no prediction in regard to it is ventured. On the occasion corresponding to this 4 years ago, all thoughts were anxiously directed to an impending civil war. All dreaded it. All sought to avert it. While the inaugural address was being delivered from this place, devoted altogether to saving the Union without war, urgent agents were in the city seeking to destroy it without war, seeking to dissolve the Union and divide effects by negotiation. Both parties deprecated war, but one of them would make war rather than let the nation survive, and the other would accept war rather than let it perish. And the war came. 1/8 of the whole population were colored slaves, not distributed generally over the Union, but localized in the southern part of it. These slaves constituted a peculiar and powerful interest. All knew that this interest was somehow the cause of the war. To strengthen, perpetuate, and extend this interest was the object for which the insurgents would rend the Union even by war. While the government claimed no right to do more than to restrict the territorial enlargement of it, neither party expected for the war the magnitude or the duration which it has already attained. Neither anticipated that the cause of the conflict might cease with, or even before, the conflict itself should cease. Each looked for an easier triumph, and a result less fundamental and astounding. Both read the same Bible and pray to the same God, and each invokes his aid against the other. It may seem strange that any men should dare to ask a just God's assistance in wringing their bread from the sweat of other men's faces. But let us judge not, that we be not judged. The prayers of both could not be answered. That of neither has been answered fully. The Almighty has his own purposes. Woe unto the world because of offenses, for it must needs be that offenses come, but woe to that man by whom the offense cometh. If we shall suppose that American slavery is one of those offenses which, in the providence of God, must needs come, but which, having continued through his appointed time, he now wills to remove, and that he gives to both North and South this terrible war as the woe due to those by whom the offense came, shall we discern therein any departure from those divine attributes which the believers in a living God always ascribe to him? Fondly do we hope, fervently do we pray, that this mighty scourge of war may speedily pass away. Yet, if God wills that it continue until all the wealth piled by the bondsman's 250 years of unrequited toil shall be sunk, and until every drop of blood drawn with the lash shall be paid by another drawn with the sword, as was said 3,000 years ago, so still it must be said, the judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether. With malice toward none, with charity for all, with firmness in the right as God gives us to see the right, let us strive on to finish the work we are in, to bind up the nation's wounds, to care for him who shall have borne the battle, and for his widow and his orphan, to do all which may achieve and cherish a just and lasting peace among ourselves and with all nations.
I couldn't think of a better way to open this series than to talk with somebody who has thought about and written about Lincoln throughout his life and continues to do so after a distinguished career already of writing about and publishing about and speaking about and teaching about Lincoln, among many other subjects.
but also somebody whom we could engage in a good sense, in the best sense, initially a conversation with some naive questions about Lincoln, some basic questions about Lincoln that will help us think about him not only throughout this series, but throughout this year of local, state, national, international commemorations of the bicentenary of the birth of the man who became our 16th president. The man we're speaking with and will be coming back to and getting good advice and counsel from throughout the series is George Anastoplo. George, just to begin, who was Abraham Lincoln?
Well, he was a man from Illinois who became president of the United States. Before that, of course, he had been a child of Kentucky, then Indiana, before settling in the Springfield area and having a career there as a rather successful lawyer, as well as one of the founders of the Republican Party in the 1850s.
So that's kind of the basic outline of both a biography and whatever else study, mythology, hagiography, analysis, anything else we're working with is that basic frame of what in the essentials of living, and except for the tragic method of his that brought about his death, it's a very basic biography in terms of those essential points.
It's not an uncommon one. For instance, his principal opponent toward the end was Stephen Douglas, especially here in Illinois. And Douglas had come in from New England, settled in Illinois, become a successful lawyer, and became prominent in the Democratic Party, and much the same kind of career, only he didn't become president.
Right.
And indeed, they both courted the same woman, Mary Todd of Lexington, Kentucky, and she announced very early in her life that she was going to marry a president of the United States, and she did.
Why should Lincoln matter to us today?
Well, he proposes, you know, he has an understanding of what the United States means or what human beings are like and what they aspire to. And so it's a challenge as well as instruction as to what respect to these matters. And so if we want to understand ourselves, it helps to get his suggestions as to what it's all about, the country, humanity at large, what really matters in political and social developments and so forth.
This really gets us to the key point of why we propose this series, Abraham Lincoln Reconsidered, why we hope to look at Lincoln from so many angles. We couldn't possibly even begin to find all the angles or explore them in only a 13-part series. But this is, to me, the key point or set of points, that Lincoln is, of course, an historical figure, a great historical figure, but he is much more than that, in that he is a philosophical figure. He is a figure who represents the best of us and who, as a writer, as an actor in the world that he found himself in, created material, participated in events which on their own could basically provide a syllabus for life and a syllabus for understanding and perhaps even engaging in the political aspects and the questions that we face each day today in the 21st century.
Well, you should notice also that he was a very skillful politician and someone who thought that the political life, the political career was was worthy of the talented human being. And so he had no apologies for that. And he was good at it, in the best sense of good.
Yeah. It's important to remember that there have been periods, and perhaps we are in a period again, history will tell, where the idea of both the term used often now, public service, but also politics itself, is not something that is merely a means of self-enrichment or a object for comic or serious derision, but that it is an end that should be attractive to people who have something to offer.
And it certainly was attractive to him.
Yes, yes.
I mean, he threw himself into it, very ambitious from very early on by various indications. There are various indications of that. And one of the things that, I mean, it's interesting to see, I mean, so much was compressed into a relatively short time. You know that he was in the Congress for one term in the House of Representatives, and in 1848, I think. While he was there, he wrote to his partner back in Springfield, the much younger partner, William Herndon.
Partner in his law firm.
In the law firm, that's right. And he says on that date, February 2nd, 1848, "I just take up my pen to say that Mr. Stevens of Georgia, a little slim, pale-faced, consumptive man with a voice like Logan's, has just concluded the very best speech of an hour's length I ever heard." You know? And then he goes on, my old withered dry eyes are full of tears yet. And then he says, "You'll send him copies when he's available." Now, it was a speech against the Mexican War, mm-hmm. by a man from Georgia who mm-hmm. became the intellectual leader of the Southern political community. Now, 13 years later, almost to the day, within a month or so, Stevens, who by that time had become the vice president of the Confederacy, 1861, gives his cornerstone speech, in which he explains why it is that the founders, including Jefferson, had been wrong about what they thought the Declaration of Independence meant, respect to all men being created equal. Insofar as they were assuming that all men are indeed equal, they were right. But they were wrong about that. The creator or nature, he leaves it open, which what's the reason is, made the African inferior. And therefore, what they had thought about slavery, we now know better. Mm-hmm. And so he gives this speech justifying continuation of the system of slavery at a time when his state has already announced for secession. Now, that's 13 years you had this movement, and it was by a man whom he thought very highly of and hoped that he might be able to persuade him not to go this way. Now, Stevens himself in the Georgia legislature, I guess it was, argued against secession, was voted down, and then went along with his state. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so this is the kind of, this is the world in which Lincoln is living, in which those states mattered very much to certain people, mattered more to the old South than to the old Northwest, which mm-hmm. where we here in Illinois live, because these states here are all created by Congress.
Right.
And therefore, the loyalty is more toward the Union.
That's one of the many things that comes out of that little capsule you've presented us with. Because, one, here's this young man, I mean, still relatively young, 38, 39 years old in Congress, way off in Washington.
That's right.
Who's come from this very humble background and who is from downstate Illinois. He's not a congressman from Chicago.
That's right.
Here he is already exhibiting not only these very keen powers of observation, but also this wry sense of humor, mm-hmm. this great ability with the pen to communicate, whether in a letter or a draft mm-hmm. or a speech or an address. Also recognizing talent around him, recognizing ability, and also implicitly in what happens over those next years, recognizing that we make choices. So here he and Stevens are, each opposing the Mexican War. We'll
That's
come
right.
back to that in a moment.
Yeah.
And each proposing opposing it on principles that they share or think they share at
yeah.
that time. And yet somebody with that background, with that level of intelligence, with that history of service could allow other things to pull him in a very, very different direction than Lincoln saw as the ideal way for political leaders and for the nation to go.
Well, the loyalty on Stevens's part ultimately is loyalty to Georgia,
mm-hmm.
Just as other Southern leaders had that to their respective states. When Stevens talks about, in the Cornerstone speech, about how the founders had been mistaken, including Mr. Jefferson,
mm-hmm.
right, about the equality, he says only about 20 years ago did we begin to recognize that this wasn't so. And what he's really, one would look at the dates, and it's obviously a time when Calhoun is beginning to have his influence,
mm-hmm.
and others have begun to have
this
their
influence. This is John C. Calhoun.
John C. Calhoun of South Carolina. And what had happened by that time is it had become obvious that slavery was not going to wither away, was not going to do what evidently people, reasonable men, North and South, had thought in 1780s, 1790s would happen, that it was going to be continued. And instead of being thought of as it was originally as a necessary evil, which we've got to put up with until we can get rid of it, it becomes something that seems to be indefinite in its time for a couple of reasons. One is it became much more profitable, evidently, because of the cotton gin and things like that, and it became something which they figured they had to have because of the danger of emancipating so many slaves, having seen what happened with, in the islands when, nearby, you know, among the French and others.
In the Caribbean, in the West Indies.
Yeah, yeah, that sort of thing. So they settled into recognition that it's going to continue. And being decent people, and that's the thing that's important, I think, and Lincoln always recognized there was a fundamental decency among the Southerners, being decent people and knowing that they can no longer expect it to go, that they're going to keep it and have to keep it, they moved from regarding it as a necessary evil, eventually to be extinguished, into a positive good.
Right.
That's we call that rationalization, but it has something to do with the fundamental decency of the people themselves.
Mm-hmm.
They don't simply say, well, we're on top and we're going to stay there and we don't care what the justice of it is. They argued it's good for them, that is say for the slaves, and it's good for us.
Mm-hmm.
That's the argument he makes in the Cornerstone speech,
right.
That is Stevens, that is.
We're speaking with George Anastoplo, professor of law at Loyola University of Chicago, longtime lecturer in the liberal arts at the University of Chicago, philosopher and prolific author on so many of these and related and other topics. George, this also brings together and shows how woven together these two issues are, that in some of the common shorthand discussion on Lincoln off and on over the years gets misunderstood or I think misapprehended, and that is that when Lincoln says throughout his career and especially, of course, in the late and last years that the goal is to preserve the Union, that is linked with the whole question of slavery. It's not entirely two separate issues or either or, because this idea of allegiance to the states and to individual states within the Union buys into an historical conception of citizenship or of belonging to a land or belonging to a region wherein one has been born by accident, the old view of European nations or other historic nations. as opposed to the idea of a nation that is built on a principle and an idea and ideals where people have citizenship in a citizenry rather than in a specific and even accidental piece of land.
You say the two issues are joined, but Lincoln recognized very early in the war that the emphasis had to be placed on preserving the Union. There were many more people in the North willing to serve and to risk their lives to defend the Union than there were to free the slaves. He recognized that, and he emphasized it from the very beginning. It was only in 62, late 62, 1862, that he could then move toward emancipation as a military measure. Now, this had been anticipated, by the way, by John Quincy Adams. John Quincy Adams had argued in his old age when he was very determined anti-slavery advocate. When he was in the Congress, he went to, you know, this is a president of the United States who goes in back into the Congress.
As a congressman, in the House of Representatives, not as a senator.
And a very vigorous anti-slavery opponent. And he argues that in the event of war, martial law could call for the emancipation of slaves. Mm-hmm. And so that's in effect what Lincoln draws upon when he goes to emancipating the slaves. Certain slaves. So there, then it partly turns into a war of emancipation. But he was very careful not to let it be that from the beginning, because that's just old black Republican doctrine. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't have the wholehearted support of the North. By black Republican, that was the term being used by the Southerners to disparage the Republican Party, because they saw it as really anti-slavery party. And he insisted it was not an anti-slavery party. It was an anti-extension of slavery party. That's different. But the Southerners felt if they could not extend, they would be overwhelmed eventually, and then they have all the problems, financial and as well as self-preservation, respect to self-preservation, that they were very fearful about.
But that still seems to point to separating the issues as a means of aiming towards some ultimate goals, as opposed to thinking that the issues are unrelated, doesn't it?
I think it can be said that he was very much against slavery. But he argued that the framers, the founders, the fathers had so arranged things that they had put it in the course of ultimate extinction, which means is it would die out without any struggle, and without any fighting, that is, because of the way everything had been constituted. And he suggested that one indication of their expectation is that what was done in the first Congress and in the Confederation Congress right before the first Congress in establishing the Northwest Ordinance, which dealt with the largest territory available to the United States, what was done there was to prohibit any slavery in this territory, out of which five states came, more than a third of the number of states in the original 13. You see, that he argued shows what they wanted. But they also knew that they had to be very careful and that it was very solidly established in the South, and they had to keep that in mind.
On the one hand, we go back as early as 1787, the Northwest Ordinance
is
adopted,
right. Yeah.
Saying slavery will not extend into the largest physical section
That's
of
right.
the new country.
That's right.
But also, it's something that points out a distinction between two kinds of people who are each necessary in any society, but I imagine particularly in a society in crisis, in a society that allows for discussion and debate, and that is the political man or political person and somebody who is more of a whether for religious or other reasons, putting morals or a kind of moral argument first. That is, the abolitionists certainly were not thinking bad things to think that slavery was this awful evil, a human bondage, servitude, etc., that needed to be stopped. But their plan, stop it right now, free the slaves right now, would not have been something that could have been implemented politically. And those people who saw this as something that even in crisis should just be left alone and let these other people go their own way and let them have their slave society and later it will wither, that was something that a political person could not stand for or could not participate in.
It depends on the political person. Carl Sandburg, who wrote a massive six-volume biography of him, observes that Lincoln was the only Republican with a national reputation who did not come out solidly against the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850, which had roused so many people in the North, like Ralph Waldo Emerson, was indignant that it was being imposed upon the North to help out catch returned slaves. Mm-hmm. Lincoln never said it was a bad thing. He thought of it as necessary, as part of the original bargain. As I say, he's the only Republican of any note who took that position, and perhaps that helped him with moderates in the North.
Is that how Sandburg saw it as well, or it's just that he identifies that?
He identifies that.
Yes.
Yeah. Whether he approves of it or not, right. He identifies it. On the other hand, the Southerners, especially in the eastern part of the South, saw that if they could not expand, which was essentially prohibited by the Republican platform, if they could not expand into new territories, they would be overwhelmed in the Congress, in the presidency, and eventually that means in the Supreme Court. And then what happens to us? They stick by the bargain and they don't interfere with us where we are, but we're less than a dozen states, really, or about a dozen, and as the country grows, what happens after that? What's going to become of us? What further restrictions are they going to place upon us? We better get out. And my own sense of this is that if they had decided to get out 25 years earlier, it would have been difficult to stop them.
Mm-hmm.
If they had decided to get out 25 years later, it would have been much easier to stop them because the North would have been much stronger, the railroads would have been established, the transportation would have been even handier for the Army and so forth. They decided to make a break at the time would make the worst possible struggle, the most bloody, the most devastating for both sides right at that particular moment. But no man could get himself elected who was going to talk about going to war. And so Lincoln kept insisting the Republican Party was not abolitionist.
Because if he had said that the Republican Party was abolitionist, that would be seen as throwing down the gauntlet war starting from the North rather than from the South.
And when one looks at just a map of who went, who seceded and when, you have six of the first seven states, South Carolina, Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, Florida, Louisiana, six of those states. The seventh was Texas. Texas was something special.
Right.
Okay. But of those six states, half of the population was made up of slaves. So they saw themselves as, as I think Jefferson says toward the end of his life, we have the wolf by the ear. We can't hold on. We can't let go.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're desperate. Now, the other thing that you have is you have people like Lincoln, when they talk about getting rid of slavery eventually, they always have to talk about the American Colonization Society. They end up with Liberia, for example, and that thing. They always have to talk about when those slaves are emancipated, as they will be gradually and not by war, then we've got to provide for them. And so that means we've got to send them away. Now, very few of them must have thought that that would ever happen. Mm-hmm. But you had to keep saying you're going to send them away in order to be sort of acceptable.
Colonization and support for repatriation, colonization, whichever terms, all in quotation marks, was in large part a rhetorical device for some of these advocates.
You had to say it, but if you stopped and looked at the figures, the costs, places where you'd send them, you know, say Latin America, Central America, certainly not to Africa all the way and so forth, it was not really feasible. Then the Southerners say to you, of these states in the Southeast, well, what do you expect us to do? What would you do if you had this many people of look that are so different from you, among you? And, of course, the Southerners always had this feeling, or many of them had the feeling, that if we'd been treated by others the way we've had to treat our slaves, what would they do, what would we do to them once we were emancipated? And they were very fearful about the risks of emancipation. You see, there you have half the population. In South Carolina, which was first to go, 57% of the population was made up slaves. Mm-hmm. And that is something which one has to keep in view. Now, it's in South Carolina that the in December of 1860, a month and a half after it's evident Lincoln is elected, it's there that secession begins. And it's there also, of course, where Calhoun had come from, and it's there also where they had this problem of slaves. Now, the other thing is not only the question of the number of slaves and the risk to you, but that number of slaves also means you have a need for a place to send them as a market to send them, and that's the territories in the West. And if the Republicans insist upon no new slave territory, what are you going to do with these slaves? They're very expensive to keep, but you can't use them. You have more than enough. You can't emancipate them, because then what happens? What ideas are they going to give? You know, if you have a number of emancipated slaves living among you, what is the effect upon the unemancipated slaves? The problems of discipline, the problems of conspiracies of all kinds. They were caught. The Southerners were caught. They were trapped.
You remind us here of something extremely important, and that is, while it is not the only way to see history, and while it is not the only way to see a situation, it's extremely important that we always try to see history and to see situations, at least in part, in the way that the people at that time would have and could have seen things. It's very easy for us to say, well, they should have done this or they should have done that, or we know that people are this or people are that. It was not only not easy to do that, but you basically had a very, very small number of people who saw all of these economic and political aspects of the equation, and really only one who also had the political skills and had reached a point where he could attempt within a world that consists as much of uncontrollable forces as controllable ones. And that was, in many ways, a great aspect of Lincoln's greatness, that he saw these things from the Southerners' point of view as well as from the abolitionists and New Englanders and from his own point of view, and then tried to find a way to work this all towards something.
Whether he was the only one that would have done that, I'm not so sure. But certainly he had a privileged position, considering where he came from.
My point only was that he wasn't the only one. Yeah. There were others, but that he was the only one who had this combination of having reached a position where he could personally and politically stake out certain claims and achieve office, perhaps. No?
Perhaps. I don't know. I suspect that if something had happened to him and, you know, fall off a horse in 1858, a number of these things could well happen.
Right.
One way of thinking about this, and it gives you an idea of the desperation of the South. That's the thing that's very difficult for us now to recognize, you know, what choices they were faced with is something to be pondered. I have the impression, I mean, I think an argument can be made that the Civil War began to be lost by the South on May 22nd, 1856, 4 years before it actually broke out. That's the day when a congressman from South Carolina went onto the floor of the Senate and beat insensible with a cane Senator Sumner of Massachusetts for an anti-slavery speech he'd given, and which he brought in, which criticized this congressman's uncle, who was in the Senate, as well as the state of South Carolina. He insulted my uncle, he insulted my state, and he comes onto the floor, this man sitting at his desk, and he proceeds to cane him. Depending on how one sees it, story, Sumner is trapped by his desk. He's beaten insensibly. It takes 3 or 4 years to recuperate. And what's interesting about that is this action was applauded throughout the South, which really goes against the grain of the chivalry that one properly associates with the South. That's how desperate they were. I mean, at any other time, one suspects that kind of action would have been recognized by them as really ungentlemanly. Cowardly. Right. You know, Sumner was a big man. He could have defended himself if he'd gotten up behind that desk. But he couldn't get out in time, and this man was able to cripple him, spinal injuries and so forth. And so Sumner is out of action for 4 years. He returns in June of 1860 to the Senate and gives a speech on the barbarism of slavery. He hadn't been cured by this right. by this thing, right? He'd been traveling in Europe, part of his recuperation and visiting and so forth. He comes back and he's still quite vigorous. But you see, this congressman resigns immediately from the House of Representatives and is reelected by an even larger majority to fill a seat that he had just vacated. Mm-hmm. And he got many canes sent to him, even a gold-headed cane and things of that kind, and dinners, testimonials in his favor, and so forth, you see, which shows you, in a way, how desperate the South had become, that this could be their response.
And how this desperation, but also how the opposition to the slave system could incite such passions.
That's right. That's right. And it's something which someone like Lincoln always advised people to moderate those criticisms. And he keeps talking about, you know, they're doing what we would do in their place. He keeps insisting on that. You see, if we were faced by the problems they're faced with, we would not likely act much different.
And this is not an advocacy of that behavior. It is a reminder of common humanity.
That's right. That's right. And he knows these people. He grew up among people like this. And so he's aware they're decent people, really. And by the way, the other thing that has to be kept in mind is most of the slaves were well treated. You know, I mean, there are these exceptional cases that one hears about. Slaves were valuable property. You don't go around mistreating them. You know, you want to treat them properly. They're more productive that way. And besides, there's a certain human bonds are established. And this is something that they were very much aware of in the South. And people got along with each other to a degree within a system that was obviously highly questionable. So it wasn't as if people were all the time hating each other and guarding against each other. See, the Southerners were aware of risks, and they knew that there was something ultimately questionable about what they were doing. And this is reflected in how they react to someone like John Brown. John Brown, with a handful of men, goes into Virginia and is going to do something with starting emancipation of the slaves. it's a trivial operation. Mm-hmm. When you think about it, I mean, it's a very small number of people involved, very little done in the way of damage, and yet it sent a shockwave through the South. Mm-hmm. You know, this is exactly what we're afraid of. And the abolitionists, especially the ones in the pulpits in the North, have been irresponsible. They are not the ones that have to live with the problems we do, and so forth. Now, we're familiar in our own time with concerns about outside agitators and how they're not to be relied upon. They don't know what we know about the problems we have, you know, that kind of talk. So that's what you had then.
These are questions that we're going to be coming back to throughout our series. These are questions we're going to be looking at from all different types of perspectives, from the historical, the political, the philosophical, the personal. We're going to be looking at how these things play out in debate, in language, in culture, in custom, and what the various legacies of these things are. Obviously, three major questions that we're not going to get to in this preview today, but that are raised by it, are where does all of this then go? How does Lincoln try to direct it in a direction that he thinks is the right way? What brought Lincoln to these points? What was his childhood? What was his famous self-education? How did he balance these things and work these things with his temperament? To what extent did he create or guide his own temperament and his own formation? And also, of course, how did those people who were slaves or who were freedmen or who were the descendants of either at that time see these issues and see Lincoln? Those are among the questions that we'll be coming back to with George Anastoplo, with other scholars, with other teachers, with other historians, with composers, with writers, with poets, etc. For now, we wanted to, though, put some of these things before you, do so from some angles that you might not have thought about, that you might not initially grab a hold of, but that we want to remind you that to really understand any question of importance, we have to ask ourselves hard questions. We have to question assumptions that we've had, and we have to do a lot of thinking and participate in worthwhile exchanges or exchanges that can help us get to worthwhile positions. We want to thank George Anastoplo for helping us to kick off this aspect of Abraham Lincoln Reconsidered, and we look forward to talking with him in the months to come. Abraham Lincoln, A Constitutional Biography, by George Anastoplo, Anastoplo, is available in paperback from Roman and Littlefield.
Fourscore and 7 years ago, our fathers brought forth upon this continent a new nation, conceived in liberty, and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. Now we are engaged in a great civil war, testing whether that nation or any nation so conceived and so dedicated can long endure. We are met on a great battlefield of that war. We have come to dedicate a portion of that field as a final resting place for those who here gave their lives that that nation might live. It is altogether fitting and proper that we should do this. But in a larger sense, we cannot dedicate, we cannot consecrate, we cannot hallow this ground. The brave men, living and dead, who struggled here have consecrated it, far above our poor power to add or detract. The world will little note nor long remember what we say here, but it can never forget what they did here. It is for us, the living, rather, to be dedicated here to the unfinished work which they who fought here have thus far so nobly advanced. It is rather for us to be here dedicated to the great task remaining before us, that from these honored dead we take increased devotion to that cause for which they gave the last full measure of devotion. That we here highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain, that this nation, under God, shall have a new birth of freedom, and that government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth.
Lincoln's words, the Gettysburg Address of 1863, and the second inaugural address of 1865 were read for us today by Chicago actor Richard Henzel. This has been the first, Abraham Lincoln Reconsidered. This series is a co-production with the Chicago History Museum. In addition to the Chicago History Museum, this series is supported by the Motorola Foundation. Matt DeStefano is associate producer, and Tim Sawyer is production assistant. I'm your host and producer, Andrew Patner. Thank you.